On This Week at Enterprise Tech, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai says that net neutrality is trying to kill your loved ones. Bitcoin is using all the electricity. Microsoft malware detection might actually install malware on your computer. And the DOJ goes after Microsoft for a fourth time. And the CEO of ScaleArk drops by to speed your transactional databases. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 268, reported December 8th, 2017. ScaleArk. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. Now the second-generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the United States or Canada, visit Eero.com. Select overnight shipping at checkout and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. Folks, it's a really, really big world. I'm going to need a little help from my friends. And of course, my friends include Mr. Lou Maresca. He's kind of a big deal over at Microsoft. You might have heard of him. Lou Maresca, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing fantastic. It's actually sunny and warm today in Seattle, so I'm a happy day for me.
Wait, didn't you just have a snowstorm the last show?
It was like lightning and yeah. So it's like up and down here, but you know, that's just how our moods are here.
Well, I heard Microsoft is working hard to implement service weather as a service. So this could be a good thing. Yeah, this is
something
this
as a service. Yeah, we need something as a service.
Now, Cheebert is still off in the middle of the ocean on a well-deserved vacation. He checks in from time to time. If he does write you back, do me a favor and tell him, hey, you're on vacation. Get back to me in a month. But we can't wait a month because we've got a great show for you. Not only do we have ScaleArk on, but there are a couple of pressing technological issues that people in the enterprise need to know about. So as we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. This is Ridiculous Excuse for Killing Net Neutrality number 247. Now, you heard the lobbyist reason for killing net neutrality, including it reduces investment in telecom infrastructure. It lets Big Brother censor the content that we consume. It's straight up un-American. And now, well, you can add one more. It will kill your loved ones. Ratcheting up the does the head of the FCC actually understand how the internet actually works level? Fresh off his head-scratching public argument that net neutrality is what allows web services to set standards for content, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai tried to lie by tie ending net neutrality to effective telemedicine for the elderly and infirmed. At his address to Project Goal, or Getting Older Adults Online, Pai said, quote, by replacing the outright ban of net neutrality with a robust transparency requirement and FTC-led consumer protection, we will enable these telemedicine services to come into being and help seniors, unquote. Effectively, he told them that net neutrality was keeping them from getting advanced, potentially life-saving treatments. Two problems with that. First, the current net neutrality rules don't ban telemedicine service prioritization. And second, Pai's repeal plan actually removes any transparency requirements. So not only can ISPs demand payment for prioritizing telemedicine, but there's not even a mechanism to know when they're throttling it in the first place. Just another day in the Pi FCC.
So SAP's private managed cloud, HANA Enterprise Cloud, already runs on Azure, but SAP thinks it's time to migrate over to more of the cloud platform. As part of its latest push, SAP will begin migration of dozens of business critical systems to Azure, including the SAP S4 HANA system supporting Concur. SAP S4 HANA is a business suite that's built on SAP's proprietary operational database system and in-memory computing platform called SAP HANA. Microsoft uses S4 and will use the process of migration and implementation as a reference for pretty much everyone else. Microsoft's deployment would consist of shifting off legacy SAP finance applications and implementing S4 HANA central finance running on Azure. Microsoft will also connect SAP's S4 to Azure AI and analytics services for more powerful financial reporting and decision making. The output of the process will be guidance of documentation and for other customers to run it on SAP on Azure. And this is the fierce partnership, as Microsoft states, building on a longtime partnership. Microsoft and SAP are harnessing each other's products to not only power our organizations, but to empower our enterprise customers to run their more mission-critical applications and workloads with S4 HANA on Azure. More and more mission-critical systems will light up the advantages of cloud-hosted and managed platforms as time, with projects like the SAP one being the baseline for the movement.
Now, even with AMD making a big splash and a big push into the CPU market, Intel owns the data center. We all know that. They have processors that hit top speeds that are comfortably above their competitors. The old wisdom was that to compete with Intel's big silicon, you needed faster parts. But one Silicon Valley veteran is taking a different tack, AI. IBM has just released the AC922. It's a server based on the SMT4, a Linux-tuned variant of IBM's Power9 processors. With four-way multithreading and 22 cores running at up to 3.3 gigahertz, the AC922 can't top the pure processing power of Intel Xeon parts, but what it does offer is blazing fast I/O and throughput. As the first processors to support PCI Express 4.0, NVLink 2.0, and OpenCAPI, IBM's processors make up for the lack of top-end processing speed with the ability to give high-bandwidth pipelines to ASICs and FPGAs, those things that are popular for AI and database accelerator applications. As it becomes more obvious that good AI needs more bandwidth, more than raw speed, perhaps IBM just positioned themselves for a better seat at the table of our AI overlords.
The AWS reInvent conference in Las Vegas is actually Amazon taking over the Las Vegas Strip to run AWS-focused technology sessions, tracks, and networking events. The theme this year was that AWS is more than just an infrastructure provider. It's going serverless and moving up the stack to be machine learning, data management, and artificial intelligence platform as well. As quoted by Amazon, the quality of data will be a differentiator for you. Data will have a crucial impact on how companies change behavior and build new systems. As part of the reInvent, the AWS announcements, including media services, a host of customers, and more databases, Alexa for Business, IoT, machine learning, artificial intelligence choices, and more. So some of the cherry-picked items in the announcement were Neptune, which is a graph-based database similar to Azure's CosmoDB, SageMaker, which is a managed service to make it easier to build, deploy, and manage machine learning workflows, DeepLens, which is a camera works with SageMaker to build visual machine learning models, Transcribe for automatic conversion of speech to text, and Amazon's Translate service, Comprehend, understanding text and pulling out insights, Glazer Select is an archival storage system for data lakes, IoT Device Defender to help the manage of IoT devices, and of course Amazon's Guard Duty to help with anomaly detection. AWS wants to become a serious contender in the space of these serverless technologies, and the amount of announcements in these areas has proved they aren't kidding around. Keep an eye out for more in the near future as the cloud giant evolves.
Now, Bitcoin has been a magical ride for investors who have seen the cryptocurrency go from about $1,000 at the start of the year to somewhere between $13,000 and, I don't know, $1 million during this broadcast. It is a highly volatile commodity. And of course, as with any highly volatile commodity, there's great opportunity for profit and loss. But there is one aspect of Bitcoin that only goes up, and that's the amount of power that the Bitcoin network uses. The power required by all Bitcoin operations has hit 32.36 terawatt hours. To put that in perspective, that's almost half the amount of power used by the entire Czech Republic. Some Bitcoin enthusiasts are crying foul, saying that transaction verification uses a negligible amount of power and that it's only the miners who are sucking down country-scale energy resources, but that's just simply not true. To understand why it's not true, it's time for a little blockchain 101. The blockchain is a digital ledger or a chain of blocks that contains all the confirmed transactions made in a cryptocurrency. A mining starts with the release of a block of transactions in Bitcoin, usually once every 10 minutes. First, miners validate individual transactions. Second, they assemble those transactions into a block. Third, they race other miners to complete a proof of work. In Bitcoin's case, that's Hashcash. The first to successfully complete and submit the proof of work is rewarded with some currency, and that miner's block is added to the blockchain, which is distributed across the network. The distributed nature of how that ledger is assembled, the fact that miners don't have to trust each other, only the core code of the cryptocurrency, is what makes the blockchain so powerful and so interesting, but also so energy wasteful. All of the miners will go through that process. That means millions of miners doing the same steps, running the same calculations, with only one of them being rewarded for doing so. With mining and transaction verification so linked, Bitcoin will only use more and more power as the proof of work becomes more and more difficult. Now you know, and knowing is half the battle, and evidently all the power.
So WeWork has continued to rapidly expand its empire, including the purchase of Lord & Taylor's flagship New York store, opening a private kindergarten, and leading a $32 million investment in women's co-working space. This past Tuesday, WeWork decided it will try and expand it further in its decisions to purchase Meetup. If you're not familiar with Meetup, it's a company just dedicated to bringing together professionals, hobbyists, and enthusiasts alike, and organize the before, during, and after of the interactions and social meetings. Meetup members organize an average of about 15,000 gatherings a day, but is making pretty much no profits when it comes to its services. WeWork's roughly 10 million square foot of leased office space, spreading out over more than 170 locations in 16 countries, is used primarily during the day. But by contrast, meetups happen primarily outside of working hours. WeWork's purchase means it now can cover the entire spread of days and hours and even holidays. The marriage of the two services allow WeWork to fill the gap in time and provide crossover solutions, as well manage the entire end-to-end process of interactions. WeWork feels that innovation will happen quickly and the two services will work symbiotically together. With the amount of funding WeWork has acquired, it will be interesting in the coming years to see if they can actually truly take advantage of their latest acquisition to bring more convenience to the social graph and the workplace.
Now, the universe likes balance. Fire and ice. And maybe Apple and Microsoft. Perhaps that's why last week was egg on Apple's face, and this week, it's Microsoft. Microsoft has released a rare out-of-band critical patch for CVE 2017-11937, a flaw that is found in Windows Defender, Microsoft Security Essentials, Endpoint Protection, 4-Point Endpoint Protection, and Exchange Server 2013 and 2016. Now, here's how it works. The malware protection engine scans files running through your OS attempting to protect you from malware. You can't shut it off. It's always running. Even if you close the process, it will restart on its own. That is actually a good thing. What isn't a good thing is the fact that 11937 describes a specifically crafted file that, when scanned by the malware protection engine, will execute and give remote code execution to the attacker. Even worse is the fact that the file can be delivered via email attachment, instant messenger, website, or any other service that exposes a file to Windows. In other words, the malware engine can be easily used to install malware. The bug was first discovered by the UK National Cybersecurity Center in pretty much all versions of Windows, either still supported or not. Sorry, XP, are affected. Supported Windows users should get the patch automatically, but if you want to check, jump into Windows Defender and make sure the engine version is 1.1.14405.2 or higher. Short story, get patched, and get patched now. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites, but first let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we all love Wi-Fi. The convenience of having wireless is second to none. It allows us to work where we want to work, and it allows us to connect where we never thought we could connect. Unfortunately, it's also really easy to get Wi-Fi done wrong, especially at the consumer level. But what if I told you that you could have enterprise-class Wi-Fi, enterprise-class connectivity, enterprise-class speed at home? Well, you can do that with Eero. Now, Eero is an enterprise-class Wi-Fi system that you can install in your home in just minutes. You simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it will walk you through each step of the process. It's quick, easy, and painless. You can easily create and share a guest network, know how many devices are connected at any given point, and check the internet speed that you're getting from your service provider. It's protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption, and more importantly, protected by experts at Eero. Within 24 hours of the crack Wi-Fi vulnerability revelation, Eero automatically pushed out a fix to all of their customers. Imagine that. A company that's proactive in security. Their incredibly fast response time and ability to push out updates automatically sets them apart from other solutions and traditional routers. And right now, they've got the second generation Eero and Eero Beacon. Eero's home Wi-Fi system started in early 2016. Since then, they've learned from hundreds of thousands of systems, making them smarter, faster, and more reliable. The new second generation Eero and Eero Beacon allows a customer to build a Wi-Fi system that's more perfectly tailored to their home than ever before. They offer more speed and range in the same high-quality, elegant design that people have come to expect. But they've also added a third 5 gigahertz radio. The second generation Eero is now tri-band and twice as fast as its predecessor, which lets customers do more simultaneously in every room of their home. And with the addition of a new Thread radio, Eero can connect to low-power devices such as locks, doorbells, other sensors, and more. Expanding your coverage in any room is easy with Eero with a beacon. You simply plug it into a wall and you're covered. And you can add as many Eero beacons as you want. If there's an outlet, there's Wi-Fi. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to pull your Wi-Fi into the next generation. For free overnight shipping in the United States and Canada, visit Eero.com at checkout. Select overnight shipping. Then enter Enterprise to make it free. That's Eero.com and enter the code Enterprise for free shipping. And we thank Eero for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it with the bites. And this one is actually a story that we've been covering for years. No, seriously, years, even longer than net neutrality. And that's the DOJ, the Department of Justice versus Microsoft. This is round 4, 5, or 6. It depends on how you're counting. Now, this past Wednesday, Microsoft filed its opening brief in the case of the United States versus Microsoft, currently before the United States Supreme Court. At stake is the ability of the United States government to compel a company to turn over digital data stored outside of the United States. That's not on our sovereign soil. Now let's take a walk. Back in August of 2014, Microsoft lost a legal battle to prevent the United States Department of Justice from seizing data from servers located in Ireland. This happened during the Obama administration. The U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York ruled that the U.S. DOJ can seize customer email and data, even though that data is stored on servers in Dublin, Ireland. Now, District Court Loretta Preska affirmed the validity of a warrant that the United States Department of Justice had received to do just that. Lou, let's wander back a little bit. This is actually even before you became a full-time host of This Week in Enterprise Tech. But I do remember we talked about this when you were a guest. This was one of these things where we kind of knew that this was going to be important. We didn't realize how important it was going to become. Why is it important that we figure out exactly what the United States government can and cannot do with data stored overseas?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, customers who use services, doesn't matter if it's Microsoft or not, their thought process is that my data is going to be secure, especially if I'm hosting in a big company like Microsoft. And if I'm, you know, traveling throughout the world, no matter where my data is kind of, you know, it's co-located, it's, you know, wherever its origin is at, I kind of feel like that's the almost defining line between, you know, where the data comes from the US, where it might come from my Asia or European, that kind of thing. And that's the understanding. So, like, you know, if I have data that's, you know, again, what DOJ is saying, though, is if you're a criminal, it doesn't really matter what boundaries there are. Right. And so I think that, you know, this line needs to be defined very clearly, not just for criminals, but for everybody. And, if, of course, there's a reverse view as well, as, you know, countries that have laws against, you know, where data goes and how it's stored and where it can be, you know, where it can be sent to, they're very worried about this, because if a company like the United States says, hey, you know, we can grab any data we want anywhere, if somebody's quote unquote a criminal or being prosecuted as a criminal, then, you know, what happens to our laws? You know, do you basically say you can't, we're not going to follow them? So there's a lot of things going on here, and I think clear lines need to be defined to help that, those the understanding of it.
I'm very glad you brought that up. We're definitely going to be diving that into a bit more, just a bit. But let's give the audience some more background, because maybe not all of them have been following TWiET for the last 3-4 years. Now, you have to remember that the United States government's case is based on the 1986 Stored Communications Act. In fact, anytime you hear a case regarding email, it's probably involving the 1986 SCA. Now, quote, this is from them. The disclosure of records under such circumstances has never been considered tantamount to a physical search under Fourth Amendment principles, and Microsoft is mistaken to argue that the SCA provides for an overseas search here, as there is no overseas search or seizure. Microsoft's reliance on principles of extraterritoriality and comity falls wide of the mark. Now, that again was from District Judge Loretta Prenska when she said that, yes, this is a warrant that should be able to go through. Now, the important part here, the one that you have to take away, is that they were essentially arguing that the Fourth Amendment does not apply because digital data does not equal physical search. So that's important. If you believe in the Constitution, as Lou said, you have to define exactly what does that mean. Does my digital footprint get the same protection as my person? I don't know. That's exactly what the Supreme Court is trying to suss out. Now, the last time we heard about this was back in 2016. Now, that was when the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit reversed, vacated, and remanded a lower court decision that would have forced Microsoft to give the United States Department of Justice emails on that server in Ireland. And that was the decision we just talked about. Judge Susan Carney wrote that the decision for the court stating that the Stored Communications Act of 1986 does not in fact authorize U.S. courts to issue and enforce judgments for the seizure of customer content that is stored exclusively on servers in foreign countries, even if the owner of those servers is a U.S.-based company. So let's go through the timeline. The Department of Justice comes to Microsoft, and this was for a drug case, and they say, we think you have data on your servers in Ireland that might help us to crack this case of a crime that happened in the United States. Microsoft says, wait a minute, we're not comfortable giving you data on a server that's in another country. In fact, you might remember around this time, Microsoft actually started up a service, a specific service that said, we will store your data on a foreign server and we will get rid of all the keys. We will have no access to that. Any access to that data has to come from that country's board set up specifically to determine whether or not data can be retrieved. Okay, so they lose. They appeal. They lose again. They appeal. And now a higher court says, no, you were right. This warrant is not applicable because it is extraterritorial. Now we get up to the present. And in the present, the United States Department of Justice is going after them again. Specifically, they're saying, look, there's never been a limit on extraterritoriality when it comes to seizures. We've got a warrant. We know that there's a crime being committed. And so therefore, there should be a clean cut case. But it's not for a lot of reasons. Now, let's get this a bit more of a glossing over, because this is a case that's been running for 3 to 4 years already. Lou, let me argue devil's advocate here. We do need a mechanism for trying to solve crimes, for getting data that will help us solve crimes, that will help to protect the laws of the land. So why shouldn't I be allowed with a warrant, if I am a government official with a warrant, so a court of law has agreed that I should have access to this information, why should I not be able to go to a Microsoft or an Amazon or an Apple and say, here's the warrant, and I know that data is stored on a server in Somalia, but I need it here and I need it now, and if you don't give it to me, I can hold you in contempt of court. What's wrong with that?
So I think there's a couple things. I think, you know, property and, money is a little different. Like, of course, they can seize money all around the world, different banks, and that's because the banks agree to this kind of use. But I think, you know, information is different. The whole saying information is power, and, you know, people have information not just about potentially the crime that has been committed, but information about other things that are proprietary and secret and important. And so I think here is where the whole idea is, you know, this is a global market and each company, country has different regulations around, you know, what things happen. Like, for instance, same thing happens when you go to a country. Some countries, you know, they can't extradite you out of the country because there's laws against that from that country. That can be extrapolated to data as well. As, you know, this particular thing is once it's here and you can't take it away. You can't ask for it. You can't take it out. And I think we have to be cognizant of these laws and we have to be appreciative of those laws in these other countries. And so giving the power to DJ to say we can do whatever we want, there's going to be still restrictions no matter where they go. So even if they win at this, you know, we might go to, you know, China and say, hey, this person's data is in China. Let's go take the data, give us the data from China. Well, Microsoft's going to have to go to China and say, can we give them the data, right? And I think there's going to be a lot more here than we think, and even the DOJ thinks. So I think it's almost a winless battle.
Right. Now, the other thing here, and Specs actually pointed this out in the chat room, is this idea of reciprocity. It may sound like a good idea. It sounds, and I understand this, because I would want to be able to go after the criminals wherever they are. But the question is, if we're going to apply our laws on digital data stored in other countries, does that mean that other countries can assert their laws on digital data stored in our country? And that becomes a, oh, hell no. You know, if there's a country that thinks a certain type of content is offensive to their particular worldview, their particular region, whatever it might be, does that mean that I have to turn over the identity of that person who may own that content? Well, no. I mean, there would be a huge outcry if our law enforcement even thought about doing that. So why, if we would never accept that, do we think that other countries would accept it from us? That just makes no sense to me. Again, that's devil's advocate. But Luke, can you think of a reason? I mean, if you were Ireland, if you were running the Microsoft data center in Ireland, you're an Irish citizen, and the United States comes to you and says, hey, I know you have this agreement where you're the gatekeeper for all of this data, but here's a warrant from a country of which you're not a citizen, and we need that data, and we're going to send people to sovereign soil to come collect those servers.
I mean, that's a tough question. I mean, I think, you know, if I was a citizen of a country where, you know, the laws say it was one thing, you know, I got to follow those laws. So I would say, you know, if the law says that the data is our data and no one can ask for it, then I'd say, no, you know, you can't have the data. Now, if it's a company where the laws are kind of gray, you know, in the same sense, I would still say no, because I think that in that same case, you know, you'd have to go through review and you know, again, it could be a business killer in some sense if people don't feel like their data is safe. So there's a lot of things to go on there, that different areas to kind of consider when it comes to that type of thing. So I would say in that case, I would almost say no in more than one scenario.
All right. And Emily the Strange in the chat room actually sums it up quite well. She says that her only problem is that we respect our laws, but criminals don't. So criminals can dance around us because not everyone plays by our rules. But here's the thing. That's not new. That's not a digital era thing. That has been happening forever, since laws have been instituted, since we had the ability to move from country to country, since multinational corporations have existed. And yes, it's a lot harder. It is a lot harder. But the alternative is you don't live by the rule of law. And I don't think that's acceptable. Here's another problem. And Luke, check me on this. I think more of us would be willing to trust that the government was only using this when they absolutely had to use it if it hadn't been so abused the last 10, 15 years. I mean, the number of times that we've had the SCA used in really sort of dodgy cases we don't even cover those anymore because they've become commonplace. Because remember, under the Stored Communications Act, any email that's on a server for more than 180 days is considered abandoned. And therefore, they don't even need a warrant to go after that information. That's still active, folks. So if you've got email that's been on Gmail or Yahoo Mail or Hotmail for more than half a year, technically the government doesn't need any approval to go take a look at it. They figure you've abandoned it. And also, we've seen a huge abuse. And yes, this really started but it was really ramped up under the Obama administration of national security letters. And that's pretty much destroyed trust in the system. I mean, Lou, I want to trust law enforcement, but doesn't law enforcement have to give me a reason to trust them before I say, okay, I think you're going to do the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, you're only good as your weakest link. So if you're having different parts of the organization, different government organizations doing things that are, you know, questionable, you're definitely going to always have to question what's going on. And I think, again, this is again, a very slippery slope when it comes to data, because, you know, the fact that because similar things like when you're extraditing somebody or when you're trying to get their money from different countries, they still have to go through a set of checks and balances and agreements with different countries and so on. And I think the same thing is going to happen here, that if they're going to start doing this with data, there's going to need to be agreements and rules and regulations and all these things around it that are wrapping what's going to happen with the data and when it can be retrieved and when it can't and what data can. And again, like, you know, how far back it can go and also all these types of things. It's going to be much bigger. I think what's going on here is they're potentially doing these suits almost to send a message. That message could be that, hey, if you're a new company, you're storing data. Your data, if we come to you, you better be ready to give it to us. Otherwise, we're going to make it public to you. If you can't, don't have as much money as companies like Microsoft, Google, and Apple, we're gonna sock it to you, and so you better be ready for it. So I think it's kind of a twofold message that's going on here from this this whole campaign.
Yeah. And again, Emily Lestrange points out something that I think a lot of people are frustrated with, which is it feels like we tie the hands of our law enforcement behind their backs. I get that. Both Cheebert and I have spent time in government service, so I get that. I absolutely get that. It feels like you're spinning your wheels a lot of time, but that's what you have to do. Because again, the alternative is to say, well, you just do what you got to do, and we'll look the other way. And if you want a clear example of where that's happening, take a look at Duterte in the Philippines right now. That's exactly what their situation is. He can get away with anything because it's for the good of the people. Well, I think for that to work, you have to build up goodwill. You have to trust that LE is doing the right thing. You have to trust that the national security letters and the SCA aren't being abused. And unfortunately, even the most diehard staunch fans, and I would put Cheebert and I in that category, have looked at what's happened the last couple of years. And we said, no, you've lost that. And you have to rebuild that. And if you want me to trust you, you have to give me a reason why I should think you're going to do the right thing. We're going to come back to that because this is a case that's going to drag on. I mean, can you imagine when we first started covering this topic in 2013, if you had told us that we would be covering it in 2017, we probably thought you were crazy. But here we are. Well, folks, next up is my favorite time of the show. It's when we get to bring a guest into the Twilight Riot who will drop knowledge on us. We've got Justin Barney, the CEO of ScaleArk. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take another moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you like your last mortgage experience? I mean, of course you did, right? I mean, it's fun. You get to go to a bank. You get to talk to some complete stranger. You get to present your receipts and your pay stubs and try to convince him or her that you are worthy of a loan. Who wouldn't want to do that? The answer is everyone. Everyone wouldn't want to do that because it's horrible. It's a terrible experience. And that's exactly why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. They realized that the mortgage experience needed to be brought up to date. So they created a client-focused technological revolution in Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or just refinancing your existing home loan. Oh, it's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. No lawyer speak, no bank print. They're just going to lay out the terms, tell you exactly what you're looking at so that you can make an informed decision. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button, as it should be in the digital age. No more banker's boxes, no more old faded receipts, no more pay stubs. One click and you're good to go. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And with those calculations, based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and help you find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. We welcome to the show Mr. Justin Barney. He is the CEO of ScaleArk. Justin, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, thank you. Luckily, I just finished my makeup just in time, so I'm ready to rock and roll.
Well, everyone needs a little powder every once in a while, so you're good to go.
Now, powder.
For the folks at home, can you explain what is ScaleArk? What exactly do you do?
Yeah, we're a software company here in Silicon Valley, and we make software that at a high level accelerates our customers' journey to the cloud. So our customers are enterprises like Dell, NASDAQ, even Microsoft, who are building more and more business-critical applications, whether they're for the everyday consumer or whether they're for B2B partners. But those applications need to be up and running 24/7. They need to perform well, and they need to be able to scale with more and more users. But now, as as enterprises are moving into the cloud, they need technology that will help them move those applications to the cloud faster. And that's exactly what our software does. So at the heart of it, the software is database load balancing software. That's really the category. It sits in between applications and databases and separates them. And then that's where we do all of our magic to make sure that these apps just run continuously and can scale and scale into the cloud as well, too.
Now, I got to ask, why would I need a consultant to move into the cloud? I mean, for most people think, this means I buy some space at a colo, or maybe I buy some computing time with AWS or with Microsoft Azure, and I'm good to go, right? I just move my apps. What would I need a consultant to do for that?
Well, that is a fantastic question. So sure, you can move your apps into the cloud, and that's pretty easy. The question is, how do you get the data into the cloud? Because for mission-critical applications, so as an example, one of our biggest customers is Dell.com. If you go to Dell.com and you surf the catalog, the only way that surfing is available is if for ScaleArc software to be load balancing the databases, both locally as well as geographically, so that you're always available. That application is always available to be surfed. So the question, though, is as you migrate these mission-critical apps to the cloud, how do you get the data into the cloud? Because you want that data to be close to your applications, and you want it to be secure and whatnot. And there, it's one piece to actually get them to actually move the data in, but now to have the app function well without having to do all of the recoding work. Not only that, but modern cloud databases from folks like Microsoft with Azure SQL DB and Amazon and even Google, they offer their own versions of modern cloud databases. And if the apps on your on-prem data centers weren't written for those modern cloud databases, they won't be able to work with them. Our software helps make those applications work with those modern cloud databases without having to do the recoding. So it actually helps our enterprise customers, again, migrate those mission-critical apps into the cloud faster.
Okay. Now, I don't know how much you can talk about this because, of course, you've got confidentiality with your clients, but what is a worst case scenario here? So let's say we've got a young startup and they realize, okay, we're going to need to scale pretty fast here. We've got demand. Right. We've got a popular service. We've got a lot of infrastructure that we never thought would be getting stressed, and it's falling apart. What's worst case scenario of migration to a cloud service?
Well, worst case scenario is always your data is not available and therefore your business is not available. So again, using, and by the way, we have lots of customers who have agreed to be public references. So if you go to our www.scalearc.com, there's lots of good video testimonials and whatnot. But the worst case is that if your infrastructure strategy fails, and that could be your on-prem or could be your cloud, or most commonly what people are looking for is that hybrid approach, right? How do you maintain an on-prem presence and also have the cloud presence? If strategy fails, either at a high level or even just architecturally at the app database level, then your app's not available and you're losing money and you're losing reputation, right? Because it's one thing for an app to be on. It's another thing for it to be able to scale. And then it's a third thing to be able to make sure that it performs well. And as we know, in today's world, if apps don't perform well, even if they're available, people will go to competitive offerings to do business. So really, the downside here is really bad for enterprises. And so, you have livestock quotes from the NASDAQ website that are being delivered with ScaleArc providing that performance scale and uptime for their database environments. As I mentioned, Dell.com. In fact, we have a company that sells movie tickets, which you probably can figure it out, and they need to be able to scale for Star Wars. I mean, think about the onslaught of people logging in to buy tickets for the upcoming Star Wars movie, and think about what the increase in that average daily peak of traffic is compared to just a normal day. It's pretty massive. So there, you know, this customer has ScaleArk deployed on-prem and in the AWS cloud, and we're able to help them scale on demand without having to recode and retool the applications on the fly so that they can meet the demand of customers and that those customers can have a fantastic experience when they use this website. So yeah, it's a great question, but the downside is bad. Imagine if everybody going to get Star Wars tickets couldn't. You know, that would be a very bad day for this customer. But luckily with ScaleArk, it's a very good day.
Yeah, it's amazing that we talk about that so cavalierly, that we can scale up with cloud applications and spin up more instances. It wasn't that far ago. It was at the beginning of This Week in Enterprise Tech, just 6 years ago, that if you had an event and you knew you had an event that was going to slam your infrastructure, you actually had to make agreements with colos. You had to make sure that you were geographically placed. You had to actually buy space, buy hardware, make everything spun up, and then it was your responsibility for maintaining all of that. Now, no one would ever think about doing that. That's backwards. That's back-asswards. It would cost way more than it would cost to buy a little extra computing power from AWS or put a little bit more power inside your colo. Now, but let me ask you this. You talked about availability, scalability, and performance. I mean, those are the things that we absolutely need out of any solution. That's what your company will be judged on in your service. But how do you do that across hybrid deployments? I mean, you were talking about how you could have some sort of hybrid deployment between your campus and AWS.
Right. Yeah.
What do you do? What does your software do in order to make sure that performance does stay balanced?
Sure. So great question. So again, at the heart of it, our software is a load balancer, much like if people are out there were familiar with like F5 or Netscaler for web load balancing. We do the same, but we are built specifically for databases. So we sit in between the applications and the databases, but the applications send us their queries for data. Right. So again, if you're surfing the Dell catalog, right, that application needs to go to the databases to fetch data based on what you're surfing, what you're looking for. So because we disaggregate the app tier from the database tier, when we get a request for data, we can send it anywhere. We can send it to database server 1, database server 2, database server 3. If we needed to go across the WAN to get data from a cloud instance, we could do that, right? Because now the app is not tied to the database. There's that proxy layer. And by the way, one of the inspirations for this was Facebook. In order for Facebook to become Facebook, they had to disaggregate their app tier from their database tier. And there's a guy, Mark Callahan, there, who's the guru from MySQL at Facebook, that was very instrumental in pioneering this. Basically, we've taken the concept and we can deliver it to any enterprise customer. But that's how we do it. So when you have ScaleArk deployed on-prem, and you have ScaleArk deployed in the cloud. Now our software can work to pull data from the fastest responding database. We can take action if a database dies to route around it so that the app doesn't see anything. If the replication of that data across databases slows down, we can take action to make sure that customers aren't getting stale data. And having that ability to do it both locally and globally is what really provides our customers with the ability to have that hybrid architecture. And actually, one of the cool things, referencing something you mentioned earlier, was at reInvent last week, a gentleman from Cisco actually did a live demonstration of migrating a business-critical app from on-prem into the AWS cloud using ScaleArk. It was really, really cool video. We were very pleased to see that in action. But it's a great way to demonstrate how we help our enterprise customers with and actually achieve an active hybrid environment.
Oh, I love that idea of sitting between the application and the database. I mean, when you disassociate that, you're absolutely right. Then you don't run into that problem of scale. We actually had a guest on the show not too long ago with NoSQL, showing off a NoSQL database. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing. They came in for Pokemon, of course, which got slammed and is always getting slammed. And they had to present a solution that was more than just, we'll spin up more boxes. Because at some point, spinning up more boxes doesn't help if the database just can't do it. But that's right. By disassociating it and having your software being able to route to the least busy database, that fixes things. How does ScaleArt compare against something like a NoSQL database?
Yeah, another great question. You're hitting out of the park today on this Friday, Padre. I love it. So for us, any database, whether it's a SQL database or a NoSQL database, can be a candidate for ScaleArt. Today, we have focused primarily on the SQL-based databases because, those make up still the majority of deployments in the world, if you just looked at all database deployments. And these are databases like MySQL, MariaDB, Microsoft SQL Server, et cetera. But also because apps using those relational databases are really relying on relational databases for full ACID compliance, for data right. consistency, et cetera, right? And we know that with NoSQL databases, if you're going to try and achieve real-time consistency, you have to do a lot of coding in the application that otherwise relational databases take care of for you. So that's where we have chosen to focus primarily. And so for us, NoSQL databases, absolutely we would look to support those and probably in a relatively soon fashion. But the value proposition may be a little bit different as we build our support for NoSQL databases, like slight variations, but still striving to provide that abstraction layer between apps and databases so that really the developers now don't have to worry so much about what does the back end look like when I do my coding. I just need to write really good queries, send them to an IP address, and let that IP address do all the magic on the back end. For us today, when we look at SQL versus NoSQL, you know, that war is over. You need right. both. And really, it's workload driven. And so we really look at what are the predominant workloads that are mission critical for applications. And that's where we're looking to for our future support of more and more databases.
I like that because it does present them both as tools. They compete, but they don't really compete. If you're doing NoSQL, you're doing a massive migration, and you're going to have to recode a lot of your applications to make it work properly. Now, you could take that short-term pain for the long-term gain, and that's great. But with ScaleArt, what you're essentially allowing us to do is to take a commodity database, something we've already got, we've already built upon, add right. a layer, and then I can just have multiple instances of that database. And I think, you know, what I want to know is, what's the upper limit? How much can I scale this before I'm actually going to start to run out of headroom, no matter how many instances I spin up?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We, every company has issues and battles that they fight with. Every software vendor, you know, there are always limits that are being tested. And for us, scale is not really one of those issues. So behind a single ScaleArt instance, I mean, we can support 100,000 queries per second. We could be doing read-write split and load balancing to a pool of 12 databases, high CPU, high storage databases. But that's a lot. And even like the busiest applications. So, you know, Dell, which I love talking about because we have a full video testimonial and all of this is documented publicly. But, you know, we have gone through five Fridays with them. Now, this they're a continuous customer, but certainly, yeah, look at that. Wow. That's cool. they've been a customer of ours for a long time, but obviously Black Friday is of hypercritical importance to them. So imagine the amount of traffic that they get from that Black Friday. But again, it's really more around just making sure that our software is rock solid, that it can take what the internet likes to throw at it, what applications like to throw at it, and just keep on rocking. And then there's always the pod architectures that, you know, we'll have multiple pairs of ScaleArt deployed across multiple pods, you know, just like you normally would with a highly available redundant architecture at the web tier as well too. So yeah, that's hopefully that answers your question.
It does. Yeah. I do want to pull in a few things from the chat room. First of all, is Patterson, who, as we're talking about databases, just realized that he hadn't heard Hadoop in a while. So here's Hadoop. We actually have a drinking game here on Twit, so everyone listening to this who just heard Hadoop needs to take a shot. The other thing I do want to point out is right now in our chat room, and this is why I love our chat room, we've got Michelle in there, Michelle McLean, who both Chibert and I have worked with at Interrupt. Michelle, first of all, love you. I'm glad to be working with you again. But also she's answering some wonderful questions in our chat room. And
just gave you a shout out.
Yeah, great job. Great job. Let's go ahead and bring in my co-host because I've been watching his head bobbing in my preview window. And I think he's got a couple of questions or concerns about this. Lou, this is a different way of looking at hybrid databases because we do add that layer between, you know, the front and the back. What's your take? I mean, there's NoSQL. We've now had two approaches that have come onto the show. Where do you see each one being useful?
You know, so this is interesting because we see a lot of organizations externally where they'll have their data and they begin migrating data to the cloud. So like I think that this was kind of brought up in the beginning by Justin is like, hey, people might have data in their on-premise databases, but then they're also starting to implement new mission critical systems within, you know, software as a service. You know, SaaS database offerings like SQL, Azure SQL, or, you know, Lambda or something like that. And I think that, you know, what you find is sometimes you need data from both points. So like, for instance, Amazon's recommendation service, I can guarantee that the data for, you know, that they use for the recommendation service is sourced from multiple different locations, whether it's, you know, whether it's on-premise databases they have or even online or multiple online. So I guess my question would be, How does this particular system, how does Scalar handle that? Like if I want to write a query that scales both on-premise and online, how does it ensure that the latency is at its lowest and that the performance is at its highest?
Yeah, great question. I want to sort of take the Hadoop mention and then roll that into the answer to your question too. So whenever I hear Hadoop, I immediately say that's more on the data warehousing side.
Exactly. Thank you.
Right. We're more OLTP, online transaction processing, where you have real-time transactional apps that need to request data fast so that whoever is using the application can get access to that data for whatever reason. And obviously online shopping is a key part. So in terms of, you know, when you have apps that are accessing data from various sources, we're not going to really get involved in that. We are strictly going to sit in front of relational databases and handle the request for queries coming in and out. Generally, if an app is doing what if I'm hearing you correctly, is really on the sharding aspect, right? Reaching out to multiple sources, pulling data together, and then joining, we're not going to get involved in that, even though we fully support if apps are sharded to begin with. But when we're doing database load balancing, whether it's, you know, our software is looking at just a single local cluster or whether it's pointed to geographically dispersed clusters, we are always measuring the response times from the databases in terms of time to first byte. So when we get a query, if it's a write, we'll make sure that it goes to a master or primary database, right? And that's holy. If we get a read, then we can look at that primary database or any number of read replicas and immediately know which one will respond the fastest. And that's where we will go. Now, and actually Microsoft as IT was a case study for us with Microsoft Community, where we were in both West Coast Data Center and East Coast Data Center. And occasionally what we would see is in a particular time of day, one data center would get so overwhelmed that things would start to slow down. And there would be little periods of time where Scalar would actually be reaching for data across the country to the other databases because it was faster than going local, because the servers had gotten to the point of being a little overwhelmed, and we know what happens to database servers when they get overwhelmed. They slow down. So, you know, it didn't happen often, but that's where the dynamic nature of Scalar software will kick in to make sure that the performance is always best. We also do things like, you know, to get a little bit more techie, like connection pooling, global connection pooling, authentication offload. But we also do transparent caching. So again, to be techie, think of a memcache layer built into our software that doesn't require any coding. to cache repetitive read queries, and that's at the actual query request level. But in general, just making sure by measuring time to first byte that we are always pulling from the fastest databases, it helps ensure that we're choosing the right path to boost performance.
So kind of a follow-up to that. So that you choose the right path. This is great that you kind of do smoke testing and verify this kind of latency over time, and then you kind of choose the right path, the path to take.
Right.
You know, let's say you only have a couple paths. Is there – I'm sure that the question would be, is there a built-in alerting for customers to say, hey, you know, it looks like at this point in time of the day, we're starting to see a slowdown, and that kind of thing. And then also a follow-up to the Memcache comment. You know, what does a customer have to do to enable Memcaching? Do they have to, you know, do it? Is it done automatically?
Yeah. So we have a ton of alerting in ScaleArc. I wouldn't say it's like machine learning where it will study patterns over time and then start to give like suggestions or, hey, you know, based on these patterns. But we do have alerting if things slow down in any particular fashion where, you know, it might trigger an alert. But the other thing that we do, because we're a proxy and we sit in between the apps and databases, we see every single request for data. And we log all of those requests, both the incoming request as well as the outgoing response, in very granular detail. And then we have an analytics package that runs on top of that. And all of this, by the way, is all API driven, all fully exportable. So you could actually stick these logs into whatever system customers have, whether it's homegrown or third party, like an AppD or New Relic or something, or even Splunk. But what we do then is give you a package so that, one, if there's a performance issue, because if things break in a network, that's generally easier. That's broken, go fix it. It's when things slow down and you don't know where in the stack it's causing the slowdown where people get where the challenge is. So we have a real-time analytics package that if there is something that is being caused in the database, we can immediately identify what is the specific query that is causing this performance degradation. But then there's a whole historical analysis package that we offer on top of that as well to do that types of historical analysis. And it's that analytics package that drives the ability to do the caching or even the firewalling as well. But again, today it's more of a tool with alerting built in, as opposed to, you know, where we would love to take it in the future would be more machine learning, sort of proactive notification, that type of thing. And then in terms of the caching, so I was using Memcache as an example. It's not Memcache per se, but it is a basic NoSQL key value store that is built into the ScaleArc software. So imagine something like your zip code doesn't change, right? And that zip code represents lots of people. So why should we have to go to the database every time to pull the zip code? You may just click in the analytics, cache that in ScaleArc. So we'll pull the result set, and this is just a very oversimplified example. We'll assign a key to that, a key value store in main memory, and then every read that comes in for that particular piece of data, instead of going to the database, we just serve it out of main memory, lightning fast. And again, that video testimonial from Dell that the Padre showed earlier, that they have a great use case of how they were able to do that. And the key thing, the difference there is, you know, Memcache is a tool that's managed by developers, right? It's an app level cache managed by the developer generally through their code. Ours, because we're transparent proxy, doesn't require any code changes to be able to cache and offload the databases and serve read data from cache. So hopefully that helps differentiate, even though we have lots of customers who still use their Memcache layer, but can augment us for some of the more granular caching that they just don't want to do in a Memcache layer.
Okay, Justin, I have to ask this because our audience is screaming at me about this. We need to ask about privacy and security concerns. You are making extensive use of caching. They're going to wonder about, especially since you're inserting yourself between the application and the database, what have you done to secure that transit layer? What have you done to make sure that a single actor, a single bad actor, is not going to be able to intercept all of that? And then what does this do for law enforcement. We just covered a story earlier on in the show about law enforcement coming after databases, coming after data stores. What can ScaleArc do, or how can I configure ScaleArc to help me deal with those concerns?
Yeah, I was going to joke and just say we just go ahead and ship all data off to the government anyway and just decide, avoid the whole thing. But that'd be joking. So we follow standard security protocols for our own software so that it is protected. Generally, we are sitting in data center. Remember, we are located directly. So generally, apps are connected directly to databases,
right.
And they're within the same proximity, and they are locked down in a database environment, generally way behind the firewalls. So our software is just being inserted primarily in using full SSL encryption up and down the stack. We have all of the standard security measures in place. And you think about, we have government customers, we have healthcare customers, I think, isn't NHS? NHS, we have National Health Service in the UK. We have federal government, although I won't get into the three-letter agency.
Right.
So, but we're generally in that same firewalled environment right next to the apps and databases. Everything is encrypted from the wire between us and the app and us and the databases. We've worked to make sure that everything is locked down within our software stack as well, too. So generally, we're going to fit right into the security paradigm that the customer has built in. And then again, whether it's a vertical specific, whether you're the government, whether you're a financial services customer, again, you know, NASDAQ is one of the public ones, but we have others as well too. Whether you're a healthcare company where personal information is of utmost importance and we have to comply with HIPAA and whatnot, we've gone out of our way to make sure that we don't. One, it's just to make sure we don't break any of the security models that our customers demand. But also, you know, how do we help do even more? And so part of that visibility aspect. But remember, we don't care necessarily about what is in the payload, right? What we want is, here's a data request. Now, how can I optimize the journey of that data in the best way for our customers so that apps are up and running, performance, scalable, et cetera? Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, that does make sense, because since you're not actually creating a new database, you're sitting between the application and the database, any existing security policy, any existing data policy, any existing privacy/security policy should be maintained. Your layer is encrypted. So
yeah, that's right. And actually, sorry, one other point too. We do not automatically cache. And in fact, I would say 60-70% of our customers use caching, but there's a chunk that don't. We have out of the box said this should never cause any data integrity issues, data consistency issues, et cetera. Let's always be conservative. So customers have to go in and actually turn on caching, because as you know, caching is a computer science exercise. Where do you cache? At what point in the stack? You know, give it out to Akamai, cache at the app layer, cache at the web layer, cache at the database layer. There's multiple layers of caching. So we just want to be a tool that our customers can use to do additional caching without having to modify their code. But our analytics is the key to that, right? Because it will show you what are the top queries that are being requested. How are they performing? Are they reads? Are they writes? And then you can get very granular in terms of what it is that you actually do cache. So we just give the customers the tool to be able to do that. And then from there, there are different ways to cache within ScaleArc. And we just make sure that is all there, but done in a secure manner so that, again, we are not breaking the security paradigm that the customers have enacted.
We have been speaking with Mr. Justin Barney. He is the CEO and president of ScaleArc. He's been telling us about how you could speed up your database across hybrid deployments by using their unique solution. Justin, I want to thank you so very much for spending time with This Week in Enterprise Tech with Dwight Wright. If you could, please, we always do this at the end of the show. Give me your elevator pitch. You're sitting in an elevator with one of our audience members who is about to do a deployment, is considering the different possibilities. How would you advocate for ScaleArc?
Yeah, I would say, you know, ScaleArc software is going to help accelerate your journey to the cloud for your business critical applications. And if that was all the time I had, that's exactly what I would tag it with. And I would say that our software inserts transparently. I'm not asking you to deploy up my software on your apps or your databases. And one, I'm going to help you speed those business critical applications into the cloud. And then for all of your applications using ScaleArc, I'm going to make sure they're always on, they're performing well, and that you can scale apps without having to make any code changes. And then I would list off some of the same customers that I've rattled off earlier to make sure that the person knows that this software is tried, true, being used every day to handle, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars of revenue, but across multiple verticals. And it's, we've got a great company with great people, and we love it when customers give us a shot too. We're also available on the AWS Marketplace, the Azure Marketplace, and the Google Launcher as well too for GCP for those who use Google.
Absolutely fantastic. And one last shout out that you get, if you could tell them where they can find out more about ScaleArc, more about you, Twitter address, web address, email address, go.
Yeah, I, you know, the best thing is just go to ScaleArc.com. It's got a lot of information there where you can do your own research. You can reach out to us if you want to get in touch with us. I'm not a huge Twitter guy. Say, I do have gray hair, if you can see. So, but please just info@scaleArc.com. We'd love to answer questions as well too. And by the way, the next version also will make coffee. I personally have gotten that baked into the product roadmap. So stay tuned for that version in 2018.
But will it cache the coffee? That's the question.
Yeah, we'll see. Why not? Stay tuned.
Again, Justin Barney, we thank you for being part of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 databases. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible. Of course, starting with my co-host, Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, I wouldn't want to do the show without my friends, and that's what makes this so fun. And could you please tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find your work, and maybe where you might be making public appearances in the near future? Because I hear that's more up your alley now.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can always find my work at dev.office.com. Of course, you can check out some new Channel 9 videos from the Connect conference that came out. We talk a little bit about MS Graph and Azure Function integration. So check that out. And of course, you know, if you're in the New York State area within the latter part of December, I'm over there. So let's do a meetup.
Yeah. And actually, we should mention that next week, we're actually recording two episodes of TWiET because both Lou and I are going to be traveling on that one Friday. And we didn't want to leave it up to chance whether or not we'd be able to get a stable connection. That's because we love you. We love you, and we didn't want you to go TWiET-less. But Lou, a pleasure. I'll see you again twice next week, yes?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
And folks, thanks to you, to the people who log in every week, who download to watch or listen. Without you, we wouldn't have an audience. Without an audience, we don't have a show. And we love doing This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we want to share that with you. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/TWiET. There you'll find not only all of our back catalog, along with the show notes, with the links to the stories that we've talked about, but you'll also see this little drop-down menu. It's a magical thing where you can choose either an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version to be delivered into your device of choice. It is the best way to support This Week in Enterprise Tech. So if you want to keep getting your enterprise goodness, please subscribe and share with your friends. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreASJ. If you follow me, you get to find out what I'm doing every week on the show, as well as what I do when I'm not in the studio. I like making things. I like going places. I like talking to people. I like watching landslides, eat roadways. So again, twitter.com/PadreASJ. Finally, thanks to everyone who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to keep doing This Week in Enterprise Tech all these years, to the studio crew, Alex and John and Burke, who make sure everything is plugged in and working. Yeah, to Alex with the man bun, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. And also, of course, to my TD, Kevin, the shark. Kevin, this is the time of the show where we offer you a chance of redemption to see if you were actually listening to the show. So your question for this week is, what is the difference between SQL and NoSQL?
One is Star Wars, the other is The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The answer was 42. Maybe next week, Kevin. Anyways, thanks again for watching, and we will see you next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.